I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. On today's show, I sit down with Mark Gardner of Ride. I'm a big Ride fan, so this was a lovely, lovely thing to get to do, and it delivered. We had such a lovely chat. We speak about some great records. We speak about, obviously, Ride and how that come about, and growing up in Oxford, and then, you know, the kind of hiatus, and then back to new music and what Ride are doing now. It's a really lovely natter, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Before we do that, a few thank yous. I'd like to thank everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. I would like to thank the Blue Murder Club podcast because those guys produce this. If you like your true crime podcast, go check that out. And the biggest thanks always go to you lot for continuing to support this podcast and listen. And trust me, if you haven't subscribed already, then do so, because I've got some wonderful episodes recorded that are coming your way very, very soon. If it's your first time listening, hello. You're kind of late to the party, but that's fine. We're a welcoming bunch. If you've joined up today to listen because you're a big fan of Ride, then when you get to the end of today's episode, which is absolutely wonderful, go and check out the episode I've done with Andy Bell of Ride, which I recorded a few years ago now, and that's just as lovely. And yeah, if you like your indie alternative music, then, there's 500 episodes in the back catalogue, so you've got a lot to choose from, but I've sat down with the likes of Interpol, the Foo Fighters, the Killers, the Kaisers, the Kooks, and then early 90s indie darlings like The Wonder Stuff and Carter and EMF and Jesus Jones, right the way through to kind of big rock acts like Motley Crue. I spoke to Tommy Lee, hip hop royalty such as Chuck D of Public Enemy. I've spoke to Madness. The list goes on. And then there's some wonderful acting talent that I've spoke to, like Maxine Peake, Joe Hartley, Thomas Turgoose, Michael Smiley, David Duchovny, through to DJs such as Fatboy Slim and producers like Butch Vig. So there's plenty for you to enjoy at the end of this episode. You can also support the podcast over on Patreon. It's a wonderful little platform over there. And if you're prepared to spend 80p a month, not only is that a gesture to support the podcast and assist with the production costs and everything that goes into the pot to continue these weekly shows to be free, what you can also get over there is an invitation to a live show, which is online, which we do once a month, and you can come along and you can get stuck in, and it's lovely. It's a really, really nice little thing where you pop up on Zoom, and if you want to have your camera off, that's fine. But if you want to get stuck into an episode, then you can. You can have your say, and we pick a nice little topic, and it's not a kind of wanky, judgy type thing. It's really friendly, and it's a lovely bunch of people. So I'd love to see you pop up at one of them. So that's part of what you get as a Patreon. You also get to watch all the episodes, upload the videos onto Patreon, so you can go and watch all the episodes ad-free, and then you also get access to a mammoth back catalogue of unreleased episodes and radio shows and stuff. So, yeah, it's $1 a month. So that's all it's going to cost. And I know times are tight at the moment, and that's why I guess most Patreons are normally sort of tenners and upwards. So that's why I kept mine at £1. Well, it's not even £1, it's $1. So it is about 80p. And you can find out about that and everything else you need to know about this podcast, where we are on the socials and stuff like that, at offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. Let's get on to the good stuff. Please enjoy today's episode of Off the Beat and Track Podcast with the wonderful Mark Gardner of Ride.
It's Off the Beat and Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we are recording. Mark Gardner, how are you?
I'm good, yeah. I have been flying around a bit today, and I have recently got to the studio. It's a bit cold in here because I haven't had the heat on. So hence I'm keeping coats and hats on. But I'm good. I did an interview there with Under the Radar as well, which is really good.
Oh, right. Okay.
So, yeah.
I bear up my game.
No. I've spoken to Don before quite a lot. So it's all good. But I mean, this is my world. There's like studio.
Yeah.
And now there's suddenly quite a lot of Ride press to do because people seem to like the record, which is nice.
Wonderful.
And then when I'm not doing that, I'm basically looking after my daughter at weekends. And then when I'm not doing that, it means that I'm away doing shows at Ride. So that's pretty much my life.
Lovely.
Know, in a sixpence, whatever you call it.
So for people that can't see this, you're in a rather lush looking studio. So what's the deal with that? Is that where Ride kind of create their magic?
Well, so the deal with this is that I stupidly sold my house in Oxford, which I was fortunate to buy when I was 21. Mm-hmm. And that was when we first signed a deal with Sire Records. And our manager at the time said, just put a bit of money down on a house. I'm like, a house? What? I was thinking about that. But anyway, it was a good move. So we had to, because houses were affordable then. So I did that. And then obviously that appreciated in value and I sold it. And then I put the money into this studio. Because I've always wanted a sort of creative space to do, you know, my thing. I was kind of tired of going to other studios, which are okay. So I wanted to create something here to make the world come to me rather than me revolve around the world. And yeah, I mean, basically this, so that this has been going for 5 years, I think. And this is Old School Sound now. And basically, yeah, you're right. This is where, pretty much 90% of the Ride record was recorded. And this was also the first time, I guess, in a way, the band felt that we'd got a kind of home sort of studio.
Mm.
However, in saying that, I would say that it felt great for a while. But then, you know, initially I was kind of just, you know, because we just got together post-COVID. And it was great because we could kind of come in for a few weeks at a time to start, you know, playing without feeling the pressure of the clock and, you know, money mounting up. And that, at that point, I was much more kind of hands on the console, and it was quite hard to sort of be the guy in the band. But that was fine because that was the way it kind of worked. So I kind of looked after the engineering and sort of mixing of the early stuff as we went, and we laid a lot of tunes down in that way, which then did become a lot of the songs for this new album. And then also I did end up finding myself cooking and cleaning. And then I hit a point where I'm like, Jesus, you know, the guy's got the studio. What an absolute nightmare. I'm exhausted doing all of this. So, you know, at that point, at a certain point, I kind of put the SOS call out to management. It's like, I need help. We need to get people in now. And that's when Richard Kennedy came in, and that was brilliant because he was just like, he just liberated me. Then suddenly I could like then get in the band because,
yeah,
you know, it's okay to sort of, you know, you can't, you know, you can kind of wear a few hats at once, but then it just gets stupid after a while. So that was great because then I suddenly was like, okay, now I can just be back in creative mode with Ride in a way. So yeah, rather than thinking about what out of 40 mics might not be, you know, functioning correctly and all the rest of it that comes with being engineer and all of that stuff. So yeah, but I mean, do you know what, it felt amazing to do that here, and in a way at times when I was doing bits of recording here, I mean, just having the music and the songs here, maybe people had left and I was just left with this beautiful music that I could just have some time to think about and to really get my head around and work in that way. It felt great. And it just felt like this was exactly the reason why I made the stupid move of sort of selling a house and putting money into a proper studio like this at this time. Do you know what I mean? I mean, also to back end it, I did also have a sort of separation with my former partner like 3 years ago. So I did actually end up living in here for like the best part of 3 years. So that wasn't the plan, but because I sold my house, you know what I mean? So it was like, but anyway, so it's kind of, it was a roof over my head for a while and my workspace, which was, you know, but that's it. And here I am. I don't live here anymore. So that's kind of, and that feels a lot healthier again.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
That's a long answer, but there you go. That's kind of what's been going on over the last few years.
Wonderful. Well, let's kick off your playlist, Mark. And I always ask guests first for track one to tell me the song that they regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
Yeah, so I remember, so I think it's got to be Rolling Stones' Gimme Shelter. And because I remember, I mean, at times I just remember every time I hear that track, I just think, what an intro.
Yeah.
so when you asked me that question, I'd sort of immediately thought, it's got to be that, Gimme Shelter. It's just, what a vibe, what a song. And yeah, sort of tremolo-y, atmospheric. Yeah. I just love it. It's just so, so good. So yeah, that's Gimme Shelter for me, for sure.
Mark, I'm always interested with asking songwriters and producers and engineers and such about intros. And, and I think the way that people get their music now is probably way different to how they first got Early Ride Records, which probably would have been records. And
those things called records, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Wonderful things are. And yeah. And it would have been pre-streaming. And you know, we've seen, I guess, sort of pop acts and such utilizing things like TikTok to get their music out and heard by a new audience.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, because a lot of that kind of pressure is to utilize them is to get heard as quickly as possible, because you're in the midst of thousands and thousands of records at everybody's disposal instantly.
Yeah, I sort of say it's like a bit of a hailstorm in a way. It's
absolutely.
Like, and your little sort of bit of hail, you've got to somehow stand out. You're on somehow. It's really hard, yeah.
And so does the pressure that puts on, I guess, artists that maybe don't have the inbuilt following that Ride have. You know, do they have to kind of just go, right, look, let's don't bore us, get to the chorus type of approach of like grab them instantly, because we're in the midst of this hailstorm, to quote what you said there. And obviously, historically, you know, when I was listening to Early Ride Records, I guess to use two obvious examples, you've got Leave Them All Behind, which is this long, expansive intro, and then you've also got Taste, which is like, bang, straight in.
Yeah.
And like, what was the kind of mindset then, and what is the mindset now with intros when you approach it?
Look, I take it beyond the intro a bit and just kind of go, when that feeling when you get a great tune together, sometimes it just feels like it's a sort of a magical thing that happens which transcends everything, and then it could make an intro a lot easier to sort of happen, because it's almost like lyrics write themselves and the tunes write themselves in a way. But of course it doesn't exactly work like that, but there is a real, it's a hard one, because I don't think I can be that calculated about it in a way. And it just feels that a certain song, you know, obviously something, to go back to your examples, like Leave Them All Behind, is a very much a sort of trancey, it sort of works on being a bit of a mantra trance-like thing that goes round and around. So I think it can take the long intro in that way, whereas, like you say, Taste is just much more of a quicker pop song in a way, and it needs to just get on with it. And And I think it's really, really hard. I mean, it's always hard to, how do you make your music stand out, and what sort of pulls the listener in? And I mean, you know, even I was, you know, I've started sort of listening to, when I go into London and stuff, I just started putting my earplugs in and just listening to things. And I remember I was thinking about this as well, because I think a band that obviously quite heavily influenced by The Cure did that really well as well. Like a song like A Night Like This or Sinking on the Head on the Door album. I was listening to those tracks a week ago when I was going into London. Just thought, God, what beautiful moods that is set up already. And then a vocal comes in. I just think the song dictates it all in the end. But then I really like soundtrack music. You know, Ennio Morricone is a real god for me. And so he's a god and John Barry in that way, because he just set a beautiful mood with the instrumentation on what they do. Immediately it's transporting, it's taking you somewhere. And that's the ultimate sort of challenge, I think. If you can get that kind of thing into a song without it being obviously, you know, anywhere, you know, but in that way, then I think the people are on board. They're on it, you know, they're on the journey, and then it's, you know, they're with you. I don't know exactly what that is. And I'm glad that I'm never really ever going to quite understand that. I sort of feel it when bands come in and do it. But it's really hard to sort of say exactly what that is, because it's just such a sort of feeling thing. And it's a sort of something that is a bit intangible in a way. And I'm really glad that it is like that, because it keeps this really interesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the last time I seen you was actually supporting The Cure. You've been supporting The Cure at Hyde Park, right?
We did, yeah. That was a big show. That's when England had just beat.
That's right.
Sweden, was it? Yeah.
Machine Day. It was so hot as well.
Chin and very.
Wasn't a good day for goths. The makeup was running everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it was a high day in that way, because it's suddenly like, well, actually, England are looking pretty decent now.
Mm.
That's just taken pretty much a lifetime to start seeing the team starting to be good. You know what I mean? And it was just. Buzzy and really buzzy. That whole day was buzzy, and obviously that any time you get to support The Cure, that's huge. And just so much respect for The Cure and Robert Smith. I love him, and it's just so nice when your heroes just turn out to be just like top people.
Yeah,
and he's definitely one for me. It was great, and it's a huge show. Yeah, I had no, I don't think we had any inkling that. It was, I just remember kind of coming out, it's just like a sea of people like, wow, I wasn't really expecting this, but it was good. Yeah, I do remember that being a great day. I think I got driven off a bit earlier because I was sort of heading towards the thing of like being a bit too high spirited and getting completely out of my head at a certain point. So I remember my tour manager putting me in a car saying, I'm getting you back to Oxford now. I was like, okay. I was having sort of on the verge of having way too much fun, if you know what I mean.
Fantastic. I'm going to take you back for track two and ask you, please, Mark, to tell me the first song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please.
Yeah, it was a weird one, because when I looked at that, I mean, obviously, I suppose some songs that mum and dad would have played, from Bread to whatever, would have, I don't know, they used to play Beatles and bits, would have done. But I really remember distinctly going on early sort of teenage holidays to St. Ives with a couple of mates. And I remember it was a sort of classic sort of teenager holiday. You might have kind of met a girl down there and had a snog or something. And I remember sort of thinking, wow, it was just that first times of meeting women, you know, and being out with your friends in a different place, you know, it's a sort of as well. But, in St. Ives. And then I remember my mate, I guess we had like a Walkman. It was like a cassette tape Walkman. And he was like, you've got to check this out. And it was that long version of Say Hello, Wave Goodbye, Soft Sal, with I think it's a clarinet intro. It goes on for ages. And I remember we were leaving on the train to go back to Oxford from Cornwall. And it was I had that such a sort of hearty, heavy feeling of like, we've just had this great time. I think I might have fallen in love with one of those girls, sort of like. and we're leaving on a train, and we probably never see him again. And it's like, and this song just played it over and over and over again, and it just seemed to be so perfect for that mood. And I just think, I don't remember ever feeling as emotional, and it just hit me so hard. There we go. That's another long intro track. Yeah. That's why I said particularly the extended one, because it goes on that beautiful, sure it is a clarinet or something, I think it's beautiful. And it just, and then the words, you know, say hello, wave goodbye. I don't know, it just really had a big impact to me, that track. So that's why that one sort of popped out when I saw that question.
That's a beautiful, beautiful record. Have you seen, I think they may even have released it as an album, but they kind of retired, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, and they played the O2. And needless to say, they finished with Say Hello, Wave Goodbye. And if you ever get 5 minutes on YouTube, watch that performance, because I have this weird thing with like goosebumps when I hear crowds singing. It blows my mind. And hearing the crowd singing that last chorus, when you get the synth kind of echo, like, sort of draws you into the chorus coming. Oh my life!
It's like, take your hands off,
mate.
It's a real. It really does.
It's the lead up bit that, which is strangers meeting for the first time to say hello, wave goodbye, and then it soars, and it's like, oh my god, he's absolutely beautiful. Mark Ormond's voice, he's different level. It's like, it's so good.
Brilliant, genius, and what a band! Also, was it Bedsitter Genius as well? But I mean. Yeah, those really were early tunes for me again. They're like the goosebump thing for sure. Yeah every time. Brilliant. I'll check that out.
Yeah, it's beautiful. You just referenced sort of mum and dad listening to Beatles and Bread and stuff like that. But growing up was in Oxford, I presume.
Yeah, it was. And
was home musical.
Yeah, it was. My mum and dad stayed together, but I think I didn't get on. I mean, they're okay. You know what I mean? It's classic sort of married couple with kids, which, of course, I get now, although I'm separated. But I mean, and I think my mum's solid. So my mum just always turned to music and my dad listened to music as well, but my mum always had music on. She was always playing music. And I think, my mum's escape was a cigarette. And listen to music all the time. And I mean, that was kind of anything from, Barbra Streisand. She loved Barbra Streisand. And there's a few of those tunes as well, which I just think are beautiful too. So she was really the one that there was always music on, for sure. So it was musical. And even now, when I had my daughter over and stuff at the weekend, it happened this weekend, and I was like, it just feels quiet. So I still have that in me as a parent, though. I like to have a radio and I like to have music, even if it's on in the background. I just like it. And my daughter said, I quite like silence. I'm sort of saying, no, I was thinking silence is like when you're dead. It's like, and it's like, I think I sort of said something like that to her, but I said, no, I like some music on in the background. And I really do. So being a parent now, and my parents, it is just that thing of that radio on, or that's the sort of soundtrack always going on in the background.
I've done over 500 of these episodes now, Mark, and the amount of people that, when I ask them about those early emotional memories, they reference being in their parents' car. Like, it's just hearing that stuff, going on family holidays and things like that, and just hearing them kind of songs. And it's weird, isn't it, how it kind of gets into your sort of fabric of you.
Yeah, and I suppose my folks did. I'm thinking about the car. They didn't really. There was music on in the car, but I remember it more so. It was always like the kitchen was the hub of the house. It was a small house, my folks didn't earn a lot of money at all, really. But I mean, it was. I don't know. Basically, that was, like I say, it was always not. My mum felt like the heart of the house in that way. So, and in the heart was the kitchen, and then there was always music going on. So like, yeah, that's kind of, I remember it. And then I think in the car occasionally they'd have like Radio 2 on or something. So it might've been Terry Wogan in the morning when we're going to being driven into school. So yeah, some tunes would come on. I remember things like Baker Street, just thinking of things that stuck up. Bruce Hornsby and the Rage as well. Like, the way it is. Like that. I was going into school. Great, great tunes. And so those tunes really, I hear them now and always sort of, it just takes me back. I mean, that's, you know, music's powerful in that way for the nostalgia element, for sure. Yeah. Time travel.
I find it really weird that some songs, like, an example of that is, years ago, my kids were probably about 10 or 11. I just had the radio on in the car, and Somewhere in My Heart by Aztec Camera come on. Perfect pop song, right? So I'm singing along, and both my kids are singing along, and I'm like, how the hell do they know this record? And some records just find their way, and everybody just seems to know them. I mean, I guess it's down to being a great songwriter. That chorus and that verse is so catchy and instantly memorable. But I was just like, how do these songs find their way? How do people like know these songs? My kids were like really young. It's an interesting thing.
It is mad. And my daughter's 9, and actually I did the same thing in the car. We were driving into Oxford the other evening, and God, it was an AC/DC track came on. I was trying to sing along to it. It's so high pitched. And she was just cracking up. But I was like, you need to know, you know, it's AC/DC. It's like, it's a tune. And she's like, what the hell is this? But there was one, I won't go too down this far down this road, but I had a mad experience with my daughter where probably she'd have been about 3 or 4. And one of the early times that I showed her what sort of daddy does as a bit of a living, I showed her a ride playing Llanowy Point at Rob De Banks festival, is it? I think on Isle of Wight. Yeah. So I showed her that clip, and then, you know, she sort of took it in, but didn't really say anything about it. I mean, she was very young. And then a couple of years later, I was checking out the mix of that song in the car, and I put it on, and immediately she just sort of went, daddy's song, daddy's song.
Wow.
Just like looked, and I was just like, my God. Like, yeah. And I was like, yeah, it is. And it's like, so she had completely clocked it, you know, at an age 4. And just to hear her say, she suddenly went, daddy's song. She was like 6 or whatever. She went, daddy's song. She loves that tune. She still loves that tune.
Oh, and that's beautiful.
Yeah, it was really like, God, that's incredible. That really did go in, and you did actually take that and remember it. You just don't know what, you know, how kids or whatever, like say, as and when they absorb music. Yeah. But again, you know, powerful thing with music every time.
Absolutely. Standing the formative years, Mark, tell me the song reminds you of your time at school, please.
I said, but the beat, Best Friend. That's right, isn't it? So I think about that because I was at middle school, and this was the music, and this tune particularly, I remember it coming on the radio at home, and it was just at the time the Scar thing had happened. And I really think about that because it's the first music that I just changed my dress sense in about 2 weeks. I was suddenly like, just from looking like nothing to them suddenly becoming a rude boy, like immediately. I just got some money from mom and went and bought the moccasins, the white talent, you know, the Black Harrington. And I absolutely loved the beat and the Specials, you know, but especially the beat were the first ones that got me onto the Scar thing. And Best Friend was coming on the radio. I was trying to record it, and I had this weird reel-to-reel thing, so you recorded it from this loudspeaker on the radio. I managed to get quite a good recording of it on this reel-to-reel thing, and then just kept playing it over and over and over on this sort of reel-to-reel thing. And I probably got my mum in the background saying, dinner's ready or whatever, you know what I mean? Because it's like, you know, it's just so sort of primitive, the recording ways then. And that really stood out for me, that track. And I suppose it still sounds amazing. And actually, I just bought that Dance Grades DVD and watched that last week. So it reminded me again of, oh yeah, you know, and then just watching Beat in those early performances. And then also realizing as well that I never, there were black and white kids at my school in Oxford. I wasn't in a posh school. I was just in a sort of middle school, which was in this estate called Barton, which was thrown up during the war. So it wasn't really supposed to stay. But so it was kind of like the next generation of people that had all been evacuated from London, I guess. So that they're kind of kids I went to school with. So it was quite mixed.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Indian, black kids, white kids. And I never even thought about, because I was so into that music at such an early stage, I never thought about race, issues, color, any of it, because I just saw bands, that's what it's about. It's about, you know, white kids, black kids playing music together. And now I sort of think, God, you know, that did more for race relations than any politician ever did at that time. That music was so important on so many levels for the youth, you know, to get on and for everybody to get on. And it still sounds amazing. And those songs were amazing. And I mean, all those groups, the ska bands were amazing.
And I think, like, as you said, it had such an impact on you that it changed how you dressed. And I think when you're young and you're looking at bands, I think certainly if we look at that era there, which was what, maybe 80, 81, and you're looking at The Beat, you're looking at The Specials, you're looking at Madness, and then I guess other music that was blowing up, they're like Adam and the Ants, like all the Dexys, like all of these bands looked like they were in a gang. And exactly, like, they all looked like a proper firm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I was just absolutely mesmerized by, I remember buying Ska magazine and looking at them like that. And that's the thing. And that's what I mean. You are looking at bands which were mixed colors, right? And it's just it's like, and different ages, you know, like I think the guy was pretty old in The Beat that was playing the saxophone and stuff. And it was just sort of like, wow, it's so inclusive and so cool that they were making this kind of music together. And of course I wanted to sort of be a skinhead and, you know, get the DMs and stuff. My mom was like, that, you know, you're not doing that. So they stopped me there. But I mean, I guess, but you know, I don't know. It just seemed to be, I didn't realize how important that music was at that time for everything, for what was going on. Around me. And I just thought, you know, black kids are groovy, man. When black and white kids get together, they make incredible music like that. Yeah. So cool.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I don't think Jerry Dammers gets the props he deserves. I mean, that guy was a real maverick.
Amazing. Yeah. And I mean, that's something I got from on that Dance Craze DVD. I was watching it and there was I think it's an arena special, which was totally on the Specials, and it kind of went to their little place, their ramshackle little room in Coventry where Two Tone was, you know, invented. It was a mess, but Jerry was so cool in that. And actually, Terry Ward didn't hardly speak. I mean, and it kind of made me think about that shy, singery, awkward kid, because that's exactly how I felt on the early days of Ride. And I felt really awkward with it. And I just thought, I'm only doing this because I'm the only one that, you know, I kind of got this because no one else is giving me singing. It's a bit that I do, you know what I mean? So, but I mean, Dammers, absolutely. And it's stuck the keys and just the music they were feeding off that turned into that music with the kind of political and social awareness as well. I mean, like I say, Ghost Town is the sound of, for me, so many of those sort of rundown post-war cities, you know, that I used to drive through that kind of grey. I used to follow Oxford United around. It's the first time I sort of traveled. I used to travel with the London Road Club, and it, it was when I used to go, the first time I toured a bit, you'd be on a bus with other fans and you'd go to some of these, you know, they were lower league, you know, so some of the sort of places, you know, from Newport to, I don't know, to Everton, to all sorts of weird ground, you know, different grounds, and start to see England and, you know, those rows of, you know, the council estates, you know, just society. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and then, and at times it's pretty bloody grey and gloomy, and just think Ghost Town sums it up. And also because I had been, I remember being in a youth club in, because I grew up in an estate in a, you know, not in the city, Oxford city centre, because it's all university, but like, you know, just as you arrive into Oxford near Barton, it's a pretty rough estate really, riseless. I do remember that being in youth club, and I do remember it being shut down. And I was thinking like, well, what the fuck am I going to do now?
Yeah.
And it's because I used to love going there. I used to love it. I used to sort of let off a lot of steam, a lot of energy. I don't really know what we did. There was music playing. We sort of kicked balls around inside and just hung out with mates. But it was really important. And I loved that place. And then it did. And after a while, it was sort of shut down. And it's like, well, what are we all going to do now? So those words were just perfect for me. Yeah.
Absolutely. And weirdly, speaking about sort of multicultural bands at that point, about a year ago, I spoke to Robin from UB40. And he was saying back at that point, like, we was doing music that no one else was doing and was being, and it was very political as well at the time, the early stuff.
And, man, 1 in 10, what a tune.
Mate.
And
I said about, how did you get a deal? And he was like, well, the first deal we got offered was by Jerry Dammers. He found them and he was like, look, I want to sign you to Two Tone. And he said, you know, we was only across in Brum from Cove, but he was like, we loved what Jerry Dammers was doing, but
yeah,
we weren't a ska band. We wanted to be a reggae band. And I just loved that at that point, there were so many bands that come through that were multicultural, that were telling it how it is. And if you're a kid then, that's fucking everything.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it is. And also it's still with me, you know, in that way, it's just ingrained. And that dub thing is huge in Ride. It always has been. Like Steve, our bass man, it's a dub. And you know, if you slow down Peace Sign, it's dub.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's a sped up dub bass line. And, and it's amazing, but I don't know. It kind of goes over people's heads a lot of the time, but it's so important for Ride, that dub element. And Steve, I think Steve always just wanted to be in a reggae band. And I don't know how he ended up being Ride. Well, we nabbed him. We stole him from a reggae band. You know, me and Andy Wirtz, our way, you know, when we were young, we're like, we've got to get him out of that reggae band and into our band. So that's how that all happened. But Steve, it's all about dub, Steve. And that's just Stephen Laws, that rhythm section. It's like Ride would be, you know, literally half the band without those guys. They really, what is it that old American manager say, you gotta give those guys a rise. But anyway, no, absolutely, it's huge for me, dub thing. And obviously I was a pothead, you know what I mean, when I was late teenager and in my early 20s I smoke a lot of pot and listen to dub stuff, and it's like, yeah, so that's a huge part of me. And it always will be, you know, because I listened and appreciated music in that way, a bit high, you know, and all of that. And obviously that's the sound of Jamaica and the weed and the groove, you know, slow it down, it's a bit hot, let's not, you know what I mean? It's like, I was explaining that to my daughter as well. She said, why is, you know, reggae music like, it's kind of quite slow? And I say, yeah, because it's hot in Jamaica and people smoke this weed stuff that's like, it just kind of, yeah, it's just nice, it's slow down, just chill out a bit. It's like, so yeah.
Tell me the first record you remember buying from a record shop, please, Mark.
So that was, did I say Just Can't Stop It, Back to the Beat, Mirror in the Bathroom, or, yeah. So from that album, that is definitely the first album that I remember. I was with my mum and I was like, I kind of had a bit of pocket money, and because of Best Friend, which I think preceded it, I was like, I've got to have that album. And yeah, so it was, I Just Can't Stop It. And I just remember it just looks great. And I just played that album to death. You know, Twist and Crawl, Mirror in the Bathroom, I mean, some of those tunes and that still sound amazing now. So yeah,
how important, you know, in your sort of teenage years were record shops for you?
I loved it. I thinking about it, there was one called Music Market in Oxford, or a couple and our price. And I mean, I used to, that was it. Any money I made, pocket money, I'd go and buy records. And at that time, of course, you know, that's an investment of time. You go and buy these things. And in my teenage years, because I was a kid that had bought a lot of records, I met these guys that had, you know, the old mobile disco unit, you know, with the light boxes and stuff like that, and used to set up in pubs and play. And they'd kind of maybe, they had all the gear, but they didn't maybe have all the records, or maybe, you know, they were busy. They got busy. So they kind of, in the end, they said, he's got so many records, this kid. So, and he's got, you know, he's got good ones. So if we set our gear up, you can go and DJ. So actually, that was quite a good early earner for me. And because I had so many 7 inches and records and, yeah, and I suppose it's like the first time that I just used to filter stuff that I thought was good to people and then be appreciated for music that you were playing. And that was great. It was a good little learner. And I really enjoyed it because my other jobs were awful, like kind of being a porter at a hotel and then a trapper setting off bloody clay pigeons and then like washing up and waiting and stuff like that in the local little hotels and stuff. So that was great when the guys would set up, and it was called Purple Hearts Disco. Terrible name. but you know, they used to set up in pubs and it was great. I'd be there underage, probably drinking it. I just pay my records, and it worked out great. They'd take half the money and they give the half to me. So that also then made me go and keep buying. I thought, I've got a duty now to keep going and buying great, you know, 7 inches and whatever's going on now, because I'm now a DJ going to play these music records to people.
And so in the midst of all of this, yeah, when did you sort of discover a guitar and stuff?
So my uncle, who got me into music initially at a young age, 8, 9, he always had guitars around. He had a Hofner, couldn't afford a Gretsch at the time, so, which is what I found out retrospectively. And he was in the Beach Boys fan club and stuff as well. So he got me into music, and there were always guitars around, and he would play with his fiance at the time. They'd play some guitar, you know, guitar songs, and it just blew me away. And then, so I did then try at an early age to sort of try and learn guitar, but I wasn't very good, and I had other things that I was doing, just charging around, you know, say youth clubs or whatever. So I just kind of put it on the back burner a bit. And then I think when I got to sort of 14, 15, started to get to know Andy at school, and I still had the Hofner guitar around. My sister had learned to play it a bit better than I had. And then I just sort of, I don't know, I just had this thing. I lost my uncle also when I was about 12, which really hit me hard. So I found it hard to sort of, you know, I don't know, just to readjust to him not being around in my life anymore. And then, so I don't know, it took a couple of years to sort of deal with that in my own kind of way. Then I was like, I've still got his guitar and I'm now going to learn to play it. And in a weird sort of way, I sort of felt that he was still with me and helped me learn it in a way, because I felt that it was something that felt so natural to me when I'd really properly committed to do it. And I did it by buying like David Bowie songbook, a Beatles songbook, and a Smith songbook. I remember the songbooks I was playing, and I started to learn to play some of those songs. So I knew how they went and I knew the rhythm of it. And then I suddenly thought, because I've learned all these chords from playing all these songs, actually I can play a lot of songs now. And then that was the time when I started to get to know Andy at training. He'd been playing guitar for a good few years before me, and he was already great on guitar. So then he kind of helped me along as well. And talking of Aztec Camera, Oblivious was an early one we used to play guitar together. Yeah. And I remember sort of learning that, and then Andy was showing me like, it's like this chords, and I was just like, wow. And so that was an early one that I remember playing in Andy's bedroom with him and sort of thinking, I'm starting to get okay with guitar. But it was always kind of, I don't know, I suppose I was always sort of more going to be the guy singing more, you know. But yeah, so that's how it all worked out with the guitar.
Tell us a little bit about confidence, Mark, because my early memories of watching early ride shows, like, you know, you was hiding behind your hair and you looked quite shy. And
yeah, can't do that anymore.
But I mean, everyone was playing with confidence, but you did look like a shy young lad on stage.
I was.
Tell me about like that. You know, was confidence an issue? You know, all of a sudden being, you know, the front man of a band.
It was a huge
and a big audience.
Exactly, it was a huge issue because I was putting myself into a terrifying position. You know, don't get me wrong, I kind of loved it. And also, I also sort of played on that shy boy sort of thing a bit as well, because I thought, I liked people that kind of hid a bit behind something. And I thought I was being more intriguing in that way. And also, I thought people in the room, I didn't want to use the stage to sort of be, you know, and I had gone and seen you too. I had seen sort of people that were really proper showmen. I'd seen Queen, you know, I mean, Jesus doesn't get much more of a showman than Freddie Mercury. So I'd seen the showman side of it, but I just thought, that's not me. And I thought, you know, I almost sort of wanted people in the room to feel that they could be me. I didn't want to sort of feel separated from the audience in that way, if that makes any sort of sense. Absolutely. And I thought the music can do the talking here, and I can just focus, concentrate, and do my thing. I wasn't confident really at all at that stage. That grew as I became a better singer and I became better at, I just got used to kind of being on stage more. But yeah, for sure, initially it was terrifying for me, definitely.
Okay. So for the next track, I'm going to ask you to tell me about your years going to nightclubs.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So Leftfield. Leftism. I do remember I went to the Marcus of Bath, one of the Marcus of Bath raves at Longleat. And I mean, I was pretty out of it, but I'm sure I remember, I might be jealous of, you know, but I'm sure Leftfield were there and they played and they dropped Melt or one of those tracks. And I'd never heard anything like it. And the place was just went off completely. I'm sure they were there playing it actually. And, but more as a DJ thing, so it wasn't like a performance. Because I just remember all of us were like, what in the hell? What just happened there? This is just, you know, and I'd found my way into going into a few raves with a few of my mates at the time, because in the same way as Primal Scream as well, because at that time, right, kind of known, and I just felt really awkward going into clubs when, and then people would be chatting to me about, I didn't feel anonymous anymore. Whereas when I went to raves, I felt completely anonymous and free again, and I just get out of it and just dance, and I absolutely loved it. It was really liberating sort of feeling for me, and I did feel part of a movement that was happening at the time. And it did, the common denominator I think was trance, that sort of trancey thing that I do think we'd kind of have some of that in Riders. We sort of mentioned about Leaving All Behind, but I mean, for me at the time, there was obviously, I was Andy Weatherall and what he was doing, Sabres and Crowded, that was brought to my attention early on by McGee and people, and then also Orbital, Leftfield, for me were just on another level. And for me, why, you know, and even people like LTJ Bookham and people like that, because I think for me they're on another level, because you didn't need to be off your head to appreciate the music. The music is so good; it always sounds incredible. I think some of the other music, you did kind of need to be a bit out of it for it to be great. And then when you weren't, it's just a bit like, well, what was this? You know. So those guys for me were like the real pioneers, and just on another level completely.
I think that separation that you just made there, I think a lot of them songs that you probably had to be nutted to really enjoy it have probably kind of faded away. But your Chimes and, you know, your Papua New Guinea's Future Sound of London, all that, they all had left anything of it. They're still there and they still sound as viable as ever.
Absolutely. And that's, again, that sort of, what is that what is that magic thing that people did then with that music? That really separates me.
Crimes, I think, Mark.
Well, if I mean, yeah.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You know, I mean, I did experiment at that time, you know, and for sure it was, and also I was not like any kid. I was more trippy sort of kid. Yeah. So the trancy, and I used to go to a lot of things called tip parties, the Infinity Projects, which were like the go and trance parties. That's the thing that I really love to go. And not a lot. I mean, maybe because I was so busy then anyway. So it's only like once every 2 or 3 months. But there was a barn not so far from Oxford where the Crips barn that used to happen in there quite a lot. I used to go to a few of them and I absolutely loved it. And I think also that was sort of something that inspired Paul Oakenfold and people because they'd caught onto that. And I just through some friends at the time, I just fell into some of those Infinity Project parties. It was amazing. And I did take a lot from that because from those sort of drug experiences at that time, it was something that for the next 2 months, I felt so creative. I wanted to sort of make and make music. It wasn't, you know, so whereas any other things I experimented with were like, no, that's not me at all because I just, you know, I've gone up and I'm down now and I don't, that's not good. I'm not liking that feeling. And, but the more mushroomy thing and the stony thing for me, that was me. And I love that because it just felt part of, creativity, you know, my whole creative journey for me at that time. And, yeah, it just made me hear things in a different way. And I think that's always sort of something that's within me and always plays a part in anything I'm creating and doing now, for sure.
Just to sort of go back a little bit before the next track, you know, you spoke about, you know, seeing bands like The Beat and seeing what they look like and how impactful that was. I'm presuming a lot of these experiences were watching Top of the Pops. And obviously yes. It's a distant memory for a lot of people now, Top of the Pops. But how was that for you to go on Top of the Pops for the first time?
Pretty bloody weird. Well, actually, the first time was I was like, "What have I got into here?" Because the first time I was the spoof keyboard player with Primal Scream.
The first time,
yeah, doing Loaded, and I remember thinking, "I've done a really stupid thing here," because I knew that Ride were heading that way. But I just remember thinking that these guys are so out of it. We're already out of it. That we're all going to be banned here. It's like and that's including me. And then I've got to then face the rest of the band and go, "Sorry, guys. I got, you know, banned because of, you know, being with Primal Scream." And that was, you know, everyone was pretty out of it during that Loaded sort of moment. And I looked like a Thunderbird puppet. I had no idea what I was doing there. And that, you know, I was young, and those guys, you know, they were further into the party sort of scene than I was at that point. So but bless them, you know, I felt well looked after. And that's it. I was going to London one day, and McGee, my phone went, and it was McGee saying, "Mark Duffy hasn't got his musicians union, so he can't go on Top of the Pops." And the guys have got, "Do you want to go on and pretend to play keyboards?" I was like, "Yeah, why not? Sounds fun." So then we did Loaded, and of course, there's hardly any vocals on it. So Bobby didn't know what to do, and possibly not the world's best dancer. But, you know, it was just, the whole thing was bizarre. But anyway, so that was the first time. And then with Ride, I think, was it Unfamiliar? We did Unfamiliar. And, you know, it felt okay. It was just a bit weird because I think you were doing live vocals then and the rest of the track was backing track. So it all just, and then you could, I can, thought this is so important. You're going out to so many people and I can't even hear what I'm singing. It's just weird. And it just felt, then you suddenly go, okay, I get it. This is just like a TV show. This isn't like a gig in any way. Because I know a lot of bands were like, oh, we're only going to do it if we're going to do it live, like New Order and stuff. And I sort of suddenly kind of got it. It's like, oh, okay. And it, I don't know, it just felt a bit, just felt weird. And it sort of, I didn't think Ride were the sort of band that would be end up on Top of the Pops. Not that I didn't want to be there. And I was really glad that we were there because I just felt that we were going into ground that we didn't particularly belong to. And we were there because our first week's sales were so high. We got such a good following at that point. It just threw us in the charts really high, playing quite unusual music on Top of the Pops. And so it's great. It's great that it happened. But it did feel weird. It felt, back to the fringe sort of, it felt awkward. It did feel really awkward. And I don't know. Yeah. I mean, there was this mythology with Top of the Pops, but the way to get, break the myth is to be on it and do it. And then you're like, okay, I get how this all works now. It's a bit weird.
All right, I'm going to take you home for track six. A favourite song from an artist from your home county, please, Mark.
Yes, First Sight. So I think I had to think about this a bit because I've settled on Radiohead, Spirit Walker, Fade Out. I love it. And it makes me, I really respect Radiohead. I mean, we crossed paths loads with them in the early days coming out of Oxford, obviously. I live like where I'm at now is just across the field from their original studio that we all used to go and use, called The Courtyard. And their management still, I think one of their managers still like in the next village from here. So yeah, I don't know. It's sort of, I don't know. I mean, what that band, initially we knew them and then, wow, I mean, respect, because they just kept it really interesting. Brilliant, total respect for everything they've done. They didn't repeat themselves. They got huge on their own terms. And that song particularly, it makes me think of, I don't know, I might be wrong, but it just makes me think of Oxford, being in Oxford and the rows of houses that I used to walk by so often, bearing down on me, the lyric and the sound of that track. It just makes me think of Oxford from an Oxford band. And when I heard that, I just thought that's just different class, that track completely. And the bends, for the bends onwards, that's it. Those guys were off. Mm. And, absolutely fair play to them. I just thought it was brilliant. That, I mean, again, a great intro. And that, and one back to the intro thing, incredible intro. The atmosphere of that track is so, so strong. And I love the words and everything about that track is just beautifully delivered.
And the video.
The video is incredible. Absolutely. Yeah. Very, when videos were a real thing, that was a genius video as well. I mean, I just thought they'd just, when they were really starting to hit it. And what a track. Brilliant, brilliant atmosphere. Like I say, it's just, that track to me is Oxford. It's walking up the Magdalen Road. It's those rows of houses. A lyric. It just makes me think about that.
There was so much music coming out of that time that we used. Sort of using sort of strings and stuff to really amplify the sort of the how Majestic record sounded, and I don't know what it is about Street Spirit. I've listened to it a million times, Mark, but it gets more and more intense as it grows, and I don't know what they're changing or what they're throwing in, but somehow it still just sounds huge and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, but there's not loads being thrown at it. I don't know how they do it. It's absolutely magical.
It is magical. And that again, it sort of goes to what I was saying earlier about intros and stuff. That's the magic that we love and why we do these things, because that stuff, magic sort of just seems to happen sometimes. Yeah. You can't sort of calculate and there's not a formula for it. It is magical. And it's otherworldly. It's transcendental. So I mean, when music becomes transcendental and just lifts you, that track does it. And like I say, huge respect to those boys. And I really like the smile they're doing as well. So it's great. I mean, and fair play to them. I remember their management were like, well, we just want to do anything like, you know, what towards what Ryder done. And they certainly did that and more, you know. So so it's like the batting thing, you know, you kind of start the bat and run and you hand it over. I mean, Supergrass as well at that time were around, and Radiohead, Swerve Driver, there's a few of those bands all around East Oxford. And it's like a baton charge. And then, like I say, you hand the baton over and then they go and take it and just, wow, they're gone with that baton. And it's great. And you know what? It's great because the music's great. And I think I was saying this to someone not long ago, that the lovely thing about, you know, especially those bands that I mentioned, I think everyone used to talk about Oxford when you were abroad or whatever as a university sort of place. That's why people knew about Oxford. Some people mentioned the football team. That's more me. But being a season ticket holder. But I mean, and now you go around and you're loads of people, when they talk about Oxford, they talk about all the music that came out of there. And that wasn't the case until Ride. I mean, we were the first to sort of, I guess, open the door on it. I mean, by chance, we thought this is going to work against us coming out of Oxford. And actually, we did what we did. Didn't pretend we were from Manchester, because that was an idea at a certain point. And then immediately A&R people kept coming because it's pretty close to London. Gave them a night out, and then all these other great bands that were sort of brewing in Oxford were discovered, and that, you know, rest is history, literally. I mean, rightly so, you know, some absolute talent that came out of Oxford, East Oxford, basically that area, because it's the Cowley Road, multicultural. You've got Caribbean influence, you've got an Irish influence. So where the Caribbean is, you've got the weed. Do you know what I mean? You know Irish music, Caribbean, plus us weird student indie kids. That's a really strong mix of people that's going to make some really interesting music, as you know, as your sort of root place where those people kind of came out of. And that's Oaks Hall. That is that area, you know, for me, that is the postcode.
It's not easy to create a scene, you know.
No,
I live in Essex, and there's been some great bands come out of Essex over the years, but
yeah,
it's never been a moment like, you know, like Manchester or Liverpool or and Oxford is one of them, you know.
Yeah.
The bands that I've worked with over the years and things like that, they're all like, oh, we're going to go to, it's Ian Davenport's at Courtyard, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right. He is,
yeah, yeah, and he's, yeah, like, oh, we're going to go to Ian Davenport. And like,
actually, two fields away from where I am. I can walk there in 10 minutes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and the amount of people that were like, oh, we're going to go and, you know, do our first thing, we're going to go to Courtyard and see Davenport. And like, because it's entrenched now that good shit comes from there.
It's true. And I mean, and I think because, yeah, like I said, I think that Cowley Road thing, the East Oxford thing was, and we had venues. There were places we all rehearsed in, same spaces. So there were rehearsal spaces, there were venues, there was a bit of pop flying around, you know. So I mean, there's a lot of students, and there's this energy where you're butting up against Oxford University. There's this mad energy exchange that goes on, and I'm not against any of those people. Boffins, a lot of them. I like all those sort of people as well, because, you know, I love Pride Said Revisited. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't have anything against people like that. I don't judge people on, you know, whatever classroom. I don't care. You know, if they're good people and interesting people, that's fine, you know. So, but I think there's a real mad energy that happens there, because, like I say, if you think about it as the Oxford tour, that they'll always show people around the beautiful dream inspired Oxford, and then they'll do a U-turn as soon as they hit the Cowley Road. It's like they don't go down it, but that's what I mean. It is literally next to all the enchanted sort of dream inspired, a beautiful, inspiring university city, which does inspire you because you're next to a lot of future politicians, future presidents. You know what I mean? You know, it's like there's always been that mad element that goes, and also because, crikey, you know, Lewis Carroll, C.S. Lewis, you know, Tolkien, you're in pubs where they used to sit and take mushrooms and then go and write incredible, you know, world, you know, obvious, you know, books that changed literary history as well. So it's like that energy is there. It's like, so, I just think there's something in the water, something in the air, in Oxford. So there's a real, you know, there's a lot of, just a real mishmash of cultures and stuff very close together. And then, where I am now is slightly just outside of Oxford. And I think that's the thing then with the approximation with London as well. You're pretty close to London, so that's quite easy to go to your labels, 40, 50 minutes away on a train or an hour, you know. And it kind of makes sense, it, you know, that it's a sort of satellite of London in a way, but vitally here, whereas different from when you're in London, it takes an hour just to get somewhere before you even to even rehearse or something. Here, you just go straight to your rehearsal room and you just get on with it. There's not that same amount of distraction going on that if you're trying to do these things in London. And just like I say, the A to B is really easy here, you know, from people's homes to the rehearsal room or whatever. It's kind of, when I think about it, I think all those elements sort of helped to create that thing. I mean, you know, we sort of shared rehearsal rooms, we shared gear, we shared crew. I mean, the crew, all the crew for Radiohead were our crew at one point. And, you know, I'd still mates with all those crew boys. You know, there's a lot of crew boys that came out of Oxford, great people, great crew guys. And they're still my mates. And, you know, like, so I hear lots about, you know, I did hear lots about the radio tours when they were touring and stuff, because we all had the same crew and they're all still our same friends, sort of same friend circle, basically.
It's your last track, Mark. And for that, I'm going to ask you to tell the listeners of this podcast about a song that you love that you think they may not know.
What did I say? Trying to think. Hold on. Oh, UFO, Big Thief.
Yeah.
Big Thief. Yeah. So I don't know what it is about this tune. So I discovered Big Thief UFO because I've been working with a band in the studio called Two Headed Horse, who are brilliant. And actually they've just, Tim, I've spoke a lot with Tim Burgess when I was on tour with him, and they do this lovely help bands type thing. And they're going to help just a bit more funds here to get the Two Headed Horse rest of the stuff mixed, because like all bands, they have no money, but they're brilliant. I really like them. And when I started to mix one of their tracks called Shimmer, they said, as a reference, I said, what's your references? They said, check out Big Thief, UFOS. I was like, I'd never heard of it. And so I checked it out. And then this was before we went on the last American tour. And that one track in particular, just can't stop playing it. Absolutely love it. And I didn't know about it. I mean, I guess quite a lot of people do. But so that's my latest sort of discovery. And that track particularly is just beautiful. And, you know, like I say, it's nice when a band will, you know, give you a tip for, you know, for a mix tip or whatever, to say, hear this. And I love it. And so all through that recent American tour we did with the Charlatans, whenever I got a chance just to play a song, I just kept playing that on the tour bus or in a hotel room. And it was very comforting for me for the whole tour. That was my early track of this year. So yeah, Big Thief, UFOS, yeah, it's great. And I've kind of listened to more of them now, and yeah, lots of other really great tracks, but that one particularly has just got that magic, you know, that thing we keep coming back to. It's got the magic, yeah.
Love it. Well, look, Mark, we've been speaking about so much great music, and we haven't really touched on yours too much. So, so what's happening with the new music?
New music with regards to Ride, obviously Interplay comes out in March, and it's basically, like I say, pretty much all recorded here. And then we did a bit in Vader studio as well. So, it's exciting because, I mean, I spoke to Under the Radar earlier as well, and Dom, I know Dom, and he just went, you know, you do know this, your best album since Nowhere. I was like, what? And I don't know, I just had a feeling when I was listening back to the mixes, and because we went through a lot of adversity to make this record, as everyone did with COVID, the darkness of that. And then we also then were in a kind of battle with our ex-manager, who was trying to make us this sort of pension fund, who's no longer with us. And it was just horrible, legal, awful, settle out of court, horrible stuff you read about that other bands go through. And it's like, we're going through the same thing. So which sort of threatened the existence of the band in a way. So I think it brought us closer at a time, and the thing that we are armed with and we were really good at, the four of us, is music. And I mean, so basically it kind of, you know, I think it, all of those things combined to make this Outmix album brilliant. And I, as I said on the earlier interview, I don't have any plans to die yet, but I could die happy now because of this record we've just made, because I think things have always niggled me about records we've made in the past and the last two records. And I don't know, but that's just me, because I'm always going to be niggled by stuff. It's part of my thing, you know. And but with this one, I think we've hit some places now that I just think I'm really happy with that. It's brilliant. That's a height that I thought we always could hit, and we are hitting it now. And I think this record shows that. And it's exciting because, yeah, I'm really excited about it, and I hope we can play lots of it live. And I hope people are ready for new blood, a new sonic blood transfusion, which I think this can do for people. It did it for me and the band, and I think it. I hope that people are ready to go on sort of a new journey with it. And I really, yeah, I feel really good about it, I have to say. And it's been lovely that Six Music picked up on Peace Sign, and then obviously The Last Frontier just came out recently, and just the, I don't know, the vital sort of, I mean, you know, lots of people say, oh, it's good and all that, but it's been, from labels to, you know, Wichita to our management, I think across the board, people are kind of going, it's one of the best, you know, that you've done, and I felt that as I started to hear the music, you know, as well, I was in the middle of it, I sort of thought, yeah, we're hitting some real heights here. So I'm, you know, who knows? I'll just see what happens. And then, you know, you've got to be bloody good now. There's so many good new bands coming up. So, you know, if we're not, then they should rightly take the stage from us. Do you know what I mean? I just see it as simply as that. It's that thing in the band, The Lost Worlds, and it's like that thing where they're playing pool and knocking the balls into the pocket. And it's like, the way you survive is to, you got to knock the other bands into the pocket and keep your balls on the table, sort of thing. And I think this will keep the balls on the table for us for another album campaign for sure, because I think we've done really good with this.
And gigs?
So gigs, yeah. Well, I know that I think we're going to be doing some shows across America, new album shows in May. And then we're going to September tour for the UK. And then before that, we are now, I'm pretty sure we're looking at, well, we're definitely doing Fuji Rock Festival this year. And there's a Korea festival after that. And then I think we're going to do an Australian tour. So I think that's all going to be in August. I think the Australia thing is TBC, to be confirmed. And there's a few other festivals popping up now, so that's, there are conversations happening probably as we speak about festivals that seem to keep coming on board. And I would expect to be doing some festivals this summer, but around our touring, but then I would think quite a lot more festivals next year as well. Because that seems to be the way it goes with an album. It sinks in a bit, then the festival seems to come the year later. But I don't know. I mean, I just don't know. And the lovely thing is with the record, I have no idea what's going to go on. I mean, and doors seem to keep opening, and it strengthens the feeling that we've done something really good and that people still want us to kind of go and play some new music, as well as obviously we've been doing the Nowhere anniversary tour and stuff like that. So that feels, yeah, that feels good to me.
Wonderful. Mark, I wish you all the best with the record and the gigs, and it's been an absolute delight talking records with you, mate. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been great speaking to you too. Sometimes when interviews are good, it feels a little bit like sort of therapy. So it's almost like a therapy. You know what I mean? So you've been one of those. Thanks for being my therapist for the last hour or so, you know what I mean?
Absolute pleasure, mate. I'm going to press stop, but don't go anywhere.
Okay, mate.
There you go. Oh, I got to chat to another one of my heroes. This really is the best job ever, and it's not slowing down. You know, you've had your episode 500 with Neil Finnaker added us a couple of weeks ago, and they're going to be coming thick and fast. I've got so many good guests coming your way. I can't wait for you to hear them all. And thanks ever so much for supporting the pod. It's such a delightful little thing to do. As mentioned at the beginning, if you could support it via the Patreon, that'd be amazing. It is like less than a pound. It's 80p a month. And even if you just join for a month and rinse that back catalogue and then unsubscribe, you could just do that. But it all goes in the pot to give you episodes like what you've just heard. Right, I think I'm done. I'll be back next time. In the meantime, be nice to each other, and I will see you soon. Thanks again for listening. Bye-bye.